Whew. Good morning, everybody. My name is Gail. I am an alcoholic. I'm nervous. I'm sorry. My date of sobriety is April 14th, 2008. Thank you, Natalie. She asked me about 2 months ago, and so I have stewed on this for two entire months. And I finally realized a few weeks ago, just turn it over to God. And that really is where I am in my life right now because of this program. I was able to just say, God, you know, give me the words, and I'll leave it up to you. So I said my sobriety date was April 14, 2008, and my story is very, I'm sure, similar to almost everybody in here. I grew up in a family of alcoholics. I am from Boston, if you can't tell by now. And so I have five of us all together, two brothers and two sisters and myself. And when I was seven, my father passed away. He had a heart attack and dropped dead, really in front of all of us. But I don't remember a lot of him, but I do remember there was a lot of violence, a lot of alcohol. And so my mother was left with five kids to raise. My youngest sister was 6 months, and my oldest brother was 14. And so she had her hands full, and she, too, grew up in a very tumultuous childhood, a lot of alcohol. All my aunts and uncles, everybody in my family drinks. Everybody. There's not one person that does not have an issue with alcohol. And so I can remember after my father died, my mother really just, her alcoholism really got out of control, and it was not a good place to grow up with my brothers and sisters and I. I ended up taking care of my younger sister, who was 6 months when my father died, and so she kind of became almost like my own child, really, you know. She's 8 years younger than me. And so just growing up, it was just rough. It was always chaotic and alcohol involved, and you know, people in and out of the house. And but I remember even being little and going into my mother's room, and she would be drinking a beer and smoking a cigarette, and I think, I can't wait till I can do that. I remember the smell of the smoke, the smell of the Budweiser, the whole thing. I loved it. I didn't like it when she drank, but I loved it. I really. And so probably, I don't know, I can't remember how old I was when I had my first drink, but I just knew it was for me. I don't know, I just knew it. I was never comfortable in my skin. I didn't want to be the center of attention. I didn't want anyone to look at me. I didn't want, you know, I just wanted to kind of fade away. And man, once I got alcohol in my system, I was a whole different person. I was the life of the party. I was, you know, I thought that person that everybody else wanted to be, which how screwed up is that? But, you know, so I got into alcohol very young. There was not really, you know, much drugs. We'd smoke pot or whatever, but there was never really, it was alcohol for me was it. And I was lucky because my mother would buy it for me. So, you know, I could have whatever I wanted when I wanted it. And it was just the greatest thing at the time. But, you know, as I got older, things really got rough at home, and it just got really, really chaotic. And so when I was 14, I met my husband. And so I just thought this was the answer to everything. You know, he had two parents, a stable family. I would go to his house on the weekends. He lived about an hour from where I lived, and I met him through a friend. I was 14, and I thought I knew it all. And I would go to his house on the weekends, and I couldn't believe they had three meals a day. Their electricity never got shut off. Their phone never got shut off. It was amazing. And so probably when I was about 16, things were really, really rough at home. And so I left home and went to live with actually his sister at the time. I mean, she's still a sister. I don't know why I said it at the time. I'm just nervous. So went to live with her. And so I didn't really drink a lot in those years. I didn't. I had ended up quitting school, got a full-time job, lived with her, and we decided to get married when I turned 18. And so we got married, and, you know, the poor guy really had no clue what he was in for. Once we really got out on our own and into our own place, I could drink as much as I wanted. I could do whatever I wanted. And so my drinking really took off then. You know, it really took off. But all I wanted at that time was a baby. You know, I thought if I could just have a baby and be the mother that my mother wasn't, and, you know, that whole story. So I think it was about 19, I got pregnant with my oldest daughter. And things were, you know, for a few years, things were really good. I always drank too much when I drank. And it would be the situation that, you know, Friday would come and I'd get the biggest bottle. They didn't have wine in a box then. So I would get the biggest bottle of wine I could find. That was good when that was invented. But I would get the biggest bottle of wine that I could find, and I would not go to bed Friday night until it was gone. And my husband at that time, he didn't drink wine. And so I would drink that whole bottle, and I could not go to bed until it was gone. And we'd go out with friends and stuff, and he'd say, you know, just take it easy. Just, you know, just have a couple drinks. And I could never do that. I had to drink it all. It didn't matter. I could be sitting at a table with three drinks in front of me, and if someone said, you know, I'm going to go get another round, do you want another one? I'd be like, yep. And he'd look at me and say, you have three drinks in front of you. And I'd be like, if you're getting one, I'm getting one. But, at that point, as long as I didn't drink, I was semi-okay. You know, it was when that whole thing that when I picked one up, I couldn't stop. So we ended up having, you know, three kids. I have three daughters, and I had gotten my GED and gone to school to be a surgical technologist. I worked in the operating room and decided to go to nursing school. And that was really all I ever wanted to do, was to be a nurse. Even when I was little, I just never thought that it was an option for me, you know, growing up the way I did or whatever. But I ended up, when the kids were little, went to nursing school, and my drinking kind of really took off then. I would go to class at night, I'd stop at the package store, buy a few nips, pour my Diet Coke, you know, and it was just, that was really where it escalated. And when, this is just how insidious this disease is. When I was in nursing school, my youngest daughter at the time, she was 10, she was diagnosed with Crohn's disease, and she was very, very sick, really, really sick. And I remember at the time, we had brought her into Children's Hospital in Boston, and they said, you know, she has Crohn's. And I remember driving home, and I'm crying and crying, and this thought comes into my head, this is a reason to drink. Like, all my life, I felt like I had been looking for that reason to justify to drink. I don't even know if that makes sense, but so then my drinking really took off. And it took off because I'm an alcoholic, not because she had Crohn's disease. Now I know that. But I thought, this is my permission to just go to town. And so it just really escalated. I was able to graduate from nursing school, and I was able to work. You know, I stayed in the operating room, and I was able to work, but it just progressed and progressed to where it was daily. I could not not drink. I couldn't. I would drive home and say, I'm not going to stop at the package store. I'm not going to stop. And sure enough, my car would pull in. And it was, I couldn't stop it. I couldn't. And my family at that point was like, please stop drinking. And I was a blackout drinker. I wouldn't remember anything. I remember one time I came out of a blackout, and I knew I had dropped my daughter off at someone's house, and I couldn't remember where I had left her. And so the time's going on, and I'm like, what am I going to do? I think I'm supposed to pick her up. I don't know where I left her. But, you know, that wasn't enough. It was not enough to, it scared me, and I thought, I'm not going to do it again. But, of course, I did it again, over and over. And that was just how it was for the past, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 years of my drinking. I'd do in, you know, outpatient, but I was so prideful that I wouldn't get help. And my family, my husband, you know, he'd say, you know, check yourself in somewhere. And I thought, oh God, I'm a nurse. I cannot show that weakness. You know, I'm supposed to take care of people, and I just couldn't do it. I could not do it. I would do outpatient programs. I'd come to meetings. But I would really come to meetings to get out of the house and to be able to stop and get booze. And so I'd stop and get booze, pour my nip in my Diet Coke bottle, and go to the meeting. You know, and it made perfect sense to me. That, to me, was where I was at, you know. And it was, you know, I was fine with that. And at the end, you know, being a nurse, I knew where I was, like, physically with the alcoholism. You know, I would have DTs. I would have to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning because my body would be shaking and make myself a drink to be able to go back to bed to sleep, to get up again and do it all over again. And it was a rough place to be in, you know. I couldn't stop. I did it every day at the end for, I don't know, maybe 2 or 3 years. And I'd hide bottles, and I would come up with the most cleverest places to hide. I mean, I lived, where can I hide it? It was almost like a game to me to see where can I put it where they won't find it. And sometimes I'd wake up in the morning and I'd crack my eye open, and there would be all the bottles I hid, my family had found when I passed out. And I'd wake up and I'd be like, oh, shit. And I would think, instead of thinking, you know, oh, look at what I'm doing to them, I think, crap, oh, I got to go back out now and buy some more. And they found it. And, where, you know, that's the sickness of it, you know. So at the end, I knew physically that my body was, you know, shutting down. I would cut my leg shaving, and I'd bleed for an hour. And I'd say, Gail, your liver is shot, because I knew that I couldn't clot anything off. I couldn't, my liver was just gone. You know, my eyes were all yellow. And I still thought that nobody knew. And that's the craziness of it. I really thought that I was pulling one over on everybody. And that, to me, is a saddest thing. That I did that to my family, you know. I really thought I was pulling one over on them. So one day I got up to, we had planned this trip with my husband's family. He's from Portugal, and we were going to go to Portugal, which I don't even know how I thought I could do that. But but this trip was coming up, and I knew, how was I going to drink there? And I knew I had to drink, you know. So I thought, well, a few weeks before, I'm going to, what I thought was, wean myself off the booze again. And we all know how that works. But anyway, so this one day I got up, and I had been trying to cut down and trying to, and I went to work, and I was a pretty good functioning alcoholic. Like, I went to work every day. Thankfully, at the time I was a manager, and so I could lock myself in my office a lot, and I didn't have a lot of direct patient care, thankfully. Thank God, because I don't know what would have happened if I had, honestly. That's hard to admit. But so I went to work, and I went in early, and I don't know what happened. I remember being in the changing room and changing in scrubs, and I fell and banged my head. And they found me. And I had a bleed in my head. And so they shipped me into Boston. And I kind of remember some of that. So they had to rush me into surgery and, you know, open and drain the bleed in my head. And so I woke up, and I remember that. But at that point, I don't think anybody realized how bad my alcoholism was. And I don't think that they knew in the hospital. So a few hours out of surgery, I went into DTs. And apparently I had a seizure, and we bled again. So they had to bring me back to surgery. And when I was in surgery, the doctor called out, my husband and kids were there, and she said, does your wife drink? And he said, no. And of course, it's a whole family disease, right? Everybody hides it. Nobody wants to talk about it. And so my kid said to my husband, "Dad, you got to tell them how bad she drinks." So he somehow, they hooked him back into the operating room on the phone, and he said, "My wife's an alcoholic." And they said, "I thought something because her blood looked like tea, like a cup of tea." So they were able to stop the bleeding, and I was kept in the ICU. They had to take a piece of my skull and keep my it open because there was so much swelling. And I was on the ventilator for 7 days. And when they finally were able to take me off the ventilator, and they had me, you know, they were trying to get me off, you know, detox me from the alcohol and the surgery, and they finally, you know, were able to wake me up and take the tube out. And I don't remember a lot, but my first thought was, where did I put that bottle? And that is how insidious and sick this disease is. And that was all I could think about, was that bottle of Captain Morgan, and where did I put it, and where did I hide it, and, you know, and I had this stupid helmet on my head because, you know, the skull flap was gone, and so my head was all caved in, and I have this helmet, and I'm like, where's the Captain Morgan? You know, but I was, that day that I fell, that was the date of my last drink, but by no means did I find recovery right away. I was awful in the hospital. They had me in 4-point restraints, and they kept saying it's the head injury. It was not the head injury. It was me wanting booze. That's really what it was. And I was just awful. And my kids now, they kind of laugh at it. They said, "Mom, if you were not a nurse, the nurses wanted to kill you. You were such a bitch." They, you know, I remember this one guy, and I had all these lines in my arm, and I was like awful and trying pulling everything out. And he came in, and he's like, "Miss Cardozo, don't pull your lines." I'm like, "Okay, I won't pull my lines." His name was like Jose or something, and he went to go out the door, and I said, "Jose." And he turns by, I go, "Look," and I ripped everything out. And so that was when they put me in the restraints. But, you know, that was just the sickness of, you know, I really was. And this whole time, I still kept, all I wanted was booze, 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 no matter, it didn't matter. So I was in there for, I don't know, probably about 10 days, and then they brought me back to the operating, and thankfully put the piece of bone back, and that was pretty bad. And I'm like, my husband, my half my head shaved, bring me, shave the rest of my head, and voila, and bring me my bottle. And he's like, are you out of your mind? So I had to go to a physical rehab place, and so the ambulance people come, and I said, I just need to stop home first before, it was in Braintree, next town over, before you, they're like, what do you mean you gotta stop home? I'm like, I forgot something at home. I really thought that they would bring me home and I could find a bottle. And I mean, I really thought that. I mean, that's the insanity of it. I really thought they would be like, okay, we'll take you home and then we'll just drive, do what you need to do. And I don't know what I thought, but anyway. So when I finally got home, my family was done. They were done completely with me. And I think my husband didn't either throw me out or him leave the house because I was just so physically sick. I think he just really, so they said, you are gonna go to a meeting, an AA meeting every single day. And I couldn't drive because of the head injury. I couldn't work. And at that point, you know, my poor husband, I had gotten us so far into debt because I would get credit cards to pay for all my booze, and we were thousands of dollars in debt. And I'd run home and try to get the meal before him, and, you know, just the whole deceptive anyway. And so it really started to hit the fan when I got home, because all these bills coming in that he had no idea that we were in these thousands of dollars of debt. They were finding all the bottles everywhere. And so when I got home, they literally said, you have no money, and you have to, we have to take you wherever you need to go. And so they would take me to a meeting. My middle daughter would drive me every day. There was a 7 o'clock meeting, and I had to go to a meeting far away from where I lived because I didn't want anybody to know that I was an alcoholic. Even though I would buy my booze every single day in my hometown, they knew me by name. they would have my bottle at Captain Morgan waiting for me at the register, and yet I didn't want to go to an AA meeting in my hometown. So for the first 3 months, it was just, it was awful. It was miserable. I would go to meetings every day, and I wanted no part of it. I thought at the end of my drinking that that was the worst part, but I think those 3 months were honestly for me the hardest part, because I didn't want to be sober. I didn't want to not drink. I didn't know how to live. I didn't know how to get up and do anything without alcohol, because everything in my whole life had become about alcohol. And really at that, you know, after about 3 months, my family was just, they were pretty much done with me, because, you know, if I was so miserable, and I wasn't going to be happy unless everybody was miserable with me. I really, as bad as my drinking was, and my kids would say to me, at least you just passed out. And when I wasn't drinking, I was just miserable to everybody. I was miserable to everybody. And so after about 3 months, my oldest daughter, I had at that point just one granddaughter, she was 4, and she really was the light. She is, I mean, all my grandkids are, but she was the light of my life. She really was, you know, she was the only one that I really would be kind to or anything. And so at one point, my oldest daughter said to me, I'm just done with you. You know, I'm not going to bring Cecilia around anymore. You're miserable. I'm done with you. And she was crying. It was a scene. And she said to me, I can't believe that you want to be like this. And something so simple, it just made me stop and say, my God, why do I want to be like this? You know, everybody talks about like they have that, you know, last moment and all that. I think for me, that was it. That was I didn't know it at the time, but I really do think that that was God speaking through her, you know, because it made me realize I don't want to be that woman. I became what I didn't want to be, my mother. And I became, I think, so much worse than that. And so that really was the moment for me where it made me step back and realize, you know, is this the woman I want to be? So that's when I kind of decided that maybe this program really has the answer. It had to be better, I think, than where I was at then. You know, anything had to be better. And so then I started going to meetings in my hometown. and I joined a group and got a sponsor. And that was hard for me to ask somebody to please, you know, be my sponsor. And, you know, I had no idea what it was, and I didn't really want to tell anybody anything. And I had grown up and lived my life with so many secrets that the thought that I had to tell somebody some of the stuff was just amazing to me. But I ended up doing that, and that was the turning point for me. That really was. I started to want to come to AA and to listen. I didn't really necessarily buy into all of that. I didn't buy into the whole God thing and all that stuff. But I, at the time, had so much coming at me. You know, was I still going to be a nurse? Where was I going to live? Was I going to be with my kids? Was I going to be... That AA, for me, became the place I wanted to be, because I knew every day the routine if I came to AA. You know, I knew that, you know, they'd say the Serenity Prayer, and that routine and that coming in every day and, you know, meeting with my sponsor up in Massachusetts, you know, we would get together and she would help me to read the book, and I couldn't understand the book. We would literally sit in the library and read it line by line, and she would explain to me what it meant, and I had no idea. And she'd be like, underline this, and I would underline it. I had no idea why I was doing it. Whatever she told me to do, I just did. But then, you know, as time went on, I really started to listen and to hear things, and people would tell me, you know, you're a sober, dignified woman. And the first time I heard that, I cried and cried and cried and cried, because I had never been dignified in anything. I never thought that I could go one day without drinking. I never. And coming in here and people telling me, you know, this is the person that you can be, was eye-opening to me. And so at one point I even, you know, in the beginning said, I need to think about who do I want to be? Like, what kind of a person do I want to be? Do I want to be that person that drops her kid off and doesn't remember where she left her? Do I want to be the woman that, you know, needs to get up at 2 o'clock and have a drink just so she can go back to sleep, you know? And that was hard, you know, to think about my life without alcohol, because it had been for so long a part of it. And they'd say, oh, you know, one day at a time, blah, blah. I'd be like, oh, please, you know, that's just not, I don't understand that. I didn't, but I just kept doing what I was told to do and coming to meetings. And there was a lot I didn't believe and a lot of things that I just did because somebody told me to do it. And I didn't know any better. I really didn't know any better. I remember one time I was somewhere and someone said, hey, you want a piece of chicken? We were like, I don't know, someone's house in Eaton. Do you want a piece of chicken? Do you like chicken? And I sat there. I didn't even know if I liked chicken. And so there was this pause in there looking at me like, do you want a piece of chicken? And I, you know, things like that, my real sobriety, I just really didn't, I couldn't get it. And but as I came slow by slow, and for me, what has, I think, a big part of just trying to be sober and trying to be, you know, a sober woman, you know, is I had to admit that I was powerless over alcohol. And I knew I was an alcoholic. There was no, I mean, I knew well before I stopped drinking that I was an alcoholic. When I couldn't not drink, when I had to drink every day, I knew I was an alcoholic. But the part of being restored to sanity, you know, and all that whole thing, I had no idea that I could have a life that I was not obsessed by alcohol. And to admit that for me, and I think it's probably true with all of us, is that if I take a drink, I don't know where I'm going to go. So if I leave here and I go pick up a drink, I know for sure that I don't have another trying to get sober again. I know that. I was whipped. So I know that today, if I don't drink, I will be okay, and I am powerless. If that for me is where, you know, the first step is, that if I take a drink, I can't tell you what will happen by the end of the day. And that really is that simple for me, that that's where I go. I don't know. Every day when I get up, I try to do, you know, the first three steps, and I, you know, read my meditation books, and I really try to think about the first three steps. And for me, that is really what keeps me sober every day. You know, that first step, that I'm powerless, and, you know, the second came to believe. When I was drinking, and I think I shared this a few weeks ago, I can remember when I really got going with my alcoholism, thinking to myself, I'm just going to stop believing in God. I'm just going to stop. Because I knew it was such a war with me to do the things that I did when I drank and to believe that there was still a God. So I just said to myself, I'm going to stop believing in God. And it was that simple for me. I just stopped and continued to drink, and I was okay. And so that I really kind of struggled with. And, you know, I had to make my God what it is for me. And it was, you know, a God that can forgive me all the things that I've done, can get me through. I mean, truly when I say, I for 2 weeks said, I just have to give this up to God, what am I going to say when I get up there? And that's not me. That's not me. You know, I want to control everything. I want to be that person that is in control and can handle everything. And, you know, even when I'm not handling everything, I think I'm handling everything. So that I had to find a God that would forgive me and that would, when I make mistakes, show me the right way, forgive me for them, and show me how to try to fix it. And that really has been a big part of it for me, is when I first got sober, my sponsor said, I don't want you to, of course, the whole thing, don't make any changes for a year and blah, blah, you don't understand. And I think he wants to leave me. I'm going to leave him and the kids don't talk to me. And, you know, but she said, you just need to do a living amends every day. And your living amends is not to drink. And after 3 months or even 4 months or 5 months, when I started to really get more into this program, I think, well, why aren't things back to the way I think they should be? Why won't they give me money? Why won't they give me the car keys? Why won't they? I'm not drinking. And I didn't realize that it was so much more than that. You know, for probably it was about 6 months before, even when the doctor said I could drive, they still wouldn't give me the keys. My husband would give me every day a dollar to put in the bucket at AA, and that would be all that I would have. And so every day I had to say to him, can I have my dollar? I mean, you want to talk about humbling? And I was back to work, and I'd be like, that effing bastard, I got to ask my dollar. And I'd go to an AA meeting and say, can you believe I have to ask him for a dollar to give to you guys? And they would be just keep coming back, just keep coming back, just keep coming back. Because I was so indignant, you know. It took me a long time to realize, you know, a long, long time to, to realize. And so I think I was maybe sober about 18 months or whatever, and my oldest daughter and her husband had moved down here, and Cecilia, my granddaughter, to Georgia. And so we ended up being like those loser parents that follow their kids around the country. And we decided to move down here. And I thought, oh, I came to my first meeting here at the Howe Place, and I thought, oh, they don't do it the same way we did it up there. They don't do it the same way. And I really was kind of a snot and sat and judged everybody, and, oh, well, we don't do it. That's not when we say the Serenity Prayer, and we say it, la, la, la. But, you know, thankfully, people reached out their hands to me, and I asked a wonderful woman to be my sponsor. And I had been here, you know, I got a job. My husband was still up in Massachusetts, and we were waiting. We were trying to sell the house, and things were a little rough anyway. I didn't really know what was going to happen. And I was out walking the dog one morning and fell and broke my leg. And so I'm in the middle of the street, like a mile from my house. It's 4 o'clock in the morning, and I couldn't, there's nobody around. Anyways, so long story short, someone stopped to help me, and I had broke my leg. And so I was non-weight-bearing for 6 weeks, and I had to have surgery. And I was here in Georgia in this house that had no furniture. I had a couch and a bed and my book. Really, that was literally all I had. And, you know, women were wonderful. They would come and take me to a meeting, or they would call and check on me. But that was really, really, I truly think that in hindsight, that God was saying, hey, you know, you need to get your shit together. You know, I didn't, that was when I really started to get into the program every day, just trying to find my God, because why would God do this to me, and blah, 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 and I'm here, and I'm all by myself, and you know. And my sponsor said, you know, Gail, God didn't do this to you. It's God that's going to get you through it, but God didn't. And that those were the things that I really needed to hear, because that was a really dark place for me in my sobriety. It was really rough for me those 6 weeks. You know, I couldn't go to meetings, or if I did, you know, it was just once or twice a week. And every day I would just pray to God, please just help me not. And thankfully I couldn't walk or couldn't drive, because I don't know, I could have gone out and gotten booze at the time. You know, it was a blessing that I was so laid up. But every day I would say, please just help me and try to show me who you want me to be, and try to be, you know, a better person, and help me to, what is the reason for this, you know? And I realize now, a few years after, that I needed that time to really make my connection. And that really was kind of where I found AA. It really was, you know, reading the book every day and just trying to understand who I was and who I wanted to be. Because I still didn't know. I had no idea. That was a really important time for me in my sobriety. And I will say, because of AA, it really was, I was able to survive it. You know, I was able to get through it, not drink, and really able to find my God at that time. That was important for me. And also, too, to try to really give up that control, the third step, and say, you know what, I got to turn this over to you and believe that whatever happens, good or bad, however it turns out, it's the way it was supposed to be. So, you know, that time really is a big part of my sobriety. It really is what kind of brought me to realize that I cannot do it by myself. I can't do it, you know, without God and without the people in these rooms. And, you know, luckily now, every day when I get up, I used to think, oh, I have to do this. And I was thinking of it actually coming here this morning. Oh, I have to go do this. And I really try now to turn around and, like, say, I get to do this. You know, I get to do this. You know, I will tell you, 6.5 years ago, you wouldn't wanted to hear what I had to say. And you wouldn't, I probably wouldn't have even shown up. I would have been passed out. It's what I get to do now for my kids and my grandkids. And I now, you know, I have 3 girls and I have 5 granddaughters. And there's another baby coming. We don't know. Will it be a boy this time? We don't know. But I get to be a part of their lives. And I get to, you know, for a long time, I wasn't sure if, you know, my husband and I would stay together. And there had been so much destruction, you know. And now I get to be the woman that I want to be for him. You know, I'm blessed. I am blessed that I get to, you know, get up every day. It's no longer, you know, oh, I have to do this. I'm allowed to do this, you know. And I can't ever forget that. When I first came in here and they would talk about, you know, being humble, I would be like, humiliating. I thought humble and humiliation were the same thing, you know. And I realize now how wrong that was, you know. I get to come here and tell my story, even though it's not what I want to do and I don't feel comfortable with it. I get to be in a home group and be an active part of that. I get to, you know, try to go out here, and it's great. I can come in here for an hour and tell a story, and, you know, it's good or bad or funny or whatever. But then I go out there. If I don't do it out there, what good is it? It doesn't do me any good. I go to work, and I'm still a nurse, thankfully, and I'm a manager, and I have a lot of people that I work with that I think are jerks. Okay? Like, I get really mad, and I go in, and I'm like, ah, this person, blah, 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 they call in sick again, and blah. But I have to remind myself, they didn't call in sick to make my day bad. They really didn't. And, you know, it's those things that if I can go out there and try to be, you know, a sober woman and to try to live this program and be open and available and try to help someone today. This was a club that I didn't really want to join. My mother, thankfully, she got sober before she passed away, and so she had 5 years of sobriety, but she never went to AA. And so I get to come to AA today, and I often think of course, I think kind of in a judgmental way, which is not right, but I think, God, imagine if she had gone to AA. Imagine how rich her life would have been for the past, you know, the 5 years before she passed. But she didn't, and she found sobriety, and she was okay with that. And I wish I could say that I was sober when she died, but I wasn't. You know, my brothers and sisters all drank, and when she finally got sober, and this is just a little funny story, but when we were all like, we're going to go do an intervention on her and get her sober. And so the 5 of us went out drinking and showed up at her house drunk to do an intervention. So, you know, now I can laugh, but at the time we were all righteous and, you know, you know. So thankfully now, you know, I just thank God I have this program, because that made sense to me at the time, and I say it now, and I'm like, holy shit. But, I get to go out there and try to be a woman of dignity, and that's how I try to live my life today. And the best thing, one of the best things I learned from this program is, if I don't know what to say or what to do, I need to just stop and think about it and ask for help. And that is one of the best things now, is that, yes, I have my family, and, you know, the promises came true. But the thing about all that is that I have a God in my life today, and I know whatever happens, I will be okay. As long as I don't pick up a drink today, and I ask God for help. And my God is different than your God, and it's different than your God, and it's what it means to me. And that's the best part of it. I don't have to share my God with anybody. It's my God. It, you know, it probably is a little screwed up or whatever, but it what works for me. And that's what this program gave me. It gave me the opportunity to find that in my life and to be able to get up in the morning and realize that I don't have to be that woman anymore. I don't have to be passed out drunk. I can be of service to others. I can be of service to my family. I can be there for my kids, my grandkids. I'm so grateful to this program that there's not enough words, there's not enough things, the club that I didn't want to be in, I get to be a part of now. It's a privilege for me to come here. And that's it. With that, I just wanted to read one thing before I start bawling my eyes out, so I think I'm done. Just from page 164. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you.